to get a level in my voice.
Yeah. It sounds,
testing, testing, 1, 2, competing with the air traffic from National Airport. And, are you picking it up all right?
Yeah. It's, it sounds kind of sibilant.
Sibilant, but you got a windscreen over the speakers and
yeah.
The microphone, so it shouldn't be too sibilant.
Well, somehow it's, well, I'm just going to assume that this is the best I can do. This is tape one, side one, of an interview of Tom Venom by Polly Stewart on June 28, 1996, at the Smithsonian Memories Tent of the 1996 Festival of American Folklife. Okay, enough of that.
Okay.
This is really open-ended, but I'm just going to ask you the kind of general questions and see where it goes.
Okay.
I think you have been associated with the Smithsonian for quite some time.
Yes, I arrived at the Smithsonian in 1975, specifically to help Ralph Renzler with ethnomusicological aspects that were being brought into play for the selection of participants in the huge 76 bicentennial festival. And I've never regretted the move. I had just finished my doctoral dissertation at Harvard and was thinking about teaching, but the Smithsonian, within a year or two of working, it seemed to me to be a good place to spend my career. And I got my 20-year button only last month. And perhaps I have a few more years here. I was almost immediately put to work doing field work for the Bicentennial Festival, particularly since I spoke German. We needed to have a certain amount of field work done in Europe among German-speaking countries, specifically Germany, Switzerland, and Austria. And I went over that summer with Ralph, and we kind of met up. He was doing some work in Italy, I believe, and in France at the time. But we were still making selections for the Bicentennial, and it was a extremely fruitful trip. I also went to the Netherlands to try to see if there was anything in the way of folklife left there. It's such a tiny country and it's so industrialized, and you can drive from one end of the country to the other in a matter of several hours. There's just very, very few folk traditions still living there. I went up to an island off the north coast called Terschelling, as I had been told that if there was any folk life left in Holland, it was probably going to be there, but I couldn't find too much. But we did, as a result of my work, particularly in Switzerland, I made the acquaintance of Brigitte Bachmann-Geiser, who is an ethnomusicologist, also an organologist, which is what I am, specializing in musical instruments. And, she kind of mapped out a fieldwork plan for me, which was took me throughout Switzerland, and the two of us put together a really wonderful collection of particularly folk music from all of the major cantons in the country. And in Austria, I also was working with a folklorist from Innsbruck, Wolfgang Traundler, and we put together a pretty good representation there. I can't really remember what came from Germany that summer, because Germany had been there the summer before, and I think we were still using some of the field work from that. But I think that by the experience of the 76 Festival, Ralph in the meantime had encouraged me to develop some film material that I had done with some former students of mine, and this kind of launched the what is now the Smithsonian Folklife Studies, which is a film monograph series, and we've gotten maybe 7 or 8 volumes of monographs and accompanying documentation on film or video. So I decided to stay.
Sounds as though it has fulfill your expectations?
Well, the Smithsonian is such a pleasure to work in. I mean, you've got, from a standpoint of research, you've got everything at your fingertips, at least since my specialty is in Native American culture and music specifically. Between the National Anthropological Archives and the Anthropology Library and material that's in the American History Museum and what's at the Library of Congress, supplementing that with field work, which I've done systematically, has enabled me to write 3 books and get them published while I was here.
It's really wonderful support, excellent support. What was it about your early experience as a folklorist or your training as a folklorist that made you attractive to these programs so that Ralph would invite you?
Well, I think actually the person who recommended me to Ralph was Alan Lomax, and I had been doing field work in Haiti over a period of about 10 years, and Haiti was one country that was going to participate, and I met Alan down there, actually met Alan in the dark. We were invited for down in the small town of Jacmel on the southern coast. I knew of Alan's field work in Haiti from 20 years earlier, but I had no idea that he was still coming down there. And the woman who was the concierge of the pension I was staying at said, "Oh, by the way, there's another ethnomusicologist," she had trouble pronouncing it, "in town, an Alan Lowe something." I thought, "Oh no, it's got to be Alan Lomax." And sure enough, it got to be sort of after dinner, and I tried all the, there aren't that many places to stay at comfortably in that town. And he didn't appear to be at any of them, but Selden Rodman, who is a sometime art historian of Haitian folk art, had a brilliant little restored 3-story Victorian house there, and I thought, God, if Alan is going to be anywhere, he's probably at Rodman's. And Selden is something of a parsimonious creature, and electricity is very expensive in Haiti, and he doesn't use light bulbs very much. So the only way you can find your way around his house is by candlelight. And so I went up on his veranda, and sure enough, I sensed that Alan was there. And we got into a long discussion about Haitian music and American Indian music, and finally Alan turned to me and said, "Well, let's go out on the street and see what each other look like." He said, "This is ridiculous." And the next thing I know is he had called Ralph when he got back to the States and said, "I met a young ethnomusicologist in Haiti who I think could be of some use to you in the Bicentennial." And I had actually had met Ralph several years earlier because John Fesperman, who was with the music instrument division at that time here, had been my organ teacher at the New England Conservatory when I was getting my master's degree. He had taken me once over to meet Ralph. That was in the years when Ralph's program was just getting started, and it was over in the Liberty Loan building before they moved to Longfellow Plaza. So I knew Ralph, and I had planned to go to Haiti that spring, and Ralph wanted me to come down and start work it was the Division of Performing Arts before it became the Folk Life Building. And I arrived and canceled my Haitian trip, and they had no idea who I was, or I mean, it was very typical, and Ralph had left for Europe, so he wasn't anybody there really to say, "Oh, this is Tom Venom, he's going to be working for us." So they were having a staff meeting at the time, and Ernestine Potter, who was the personnel officer, I said, "Well, can you come back tomorrow?" And I did, and she took me into Bob Byington's office, and Bob sort of took off his glasses and rubbed his eyes and said, "Now, just exactly what did Ralph promise you?" That's how I got hired. So, anyway, it was one of Ralph's more quixotic aspects. He had neglected to say anything.
Isn't that odd how these peculiar twists and turns work into a career?
Yeah.
Are you, you started out as a keyboard instrumentalist.
My mother raised me to play the piano, and I did that right straight through college, and I've been involved with music in a number of different ways throughout my life, and then eventually ended up in graduate school, and really got into American Indian music quite late, almost at the time when I was looking for a topic for my dissertation.
Yeah. Who was your advisor at Harvard?
At Harvard? My advisor there was Professor John Ward, who's a specialist in English Renaissance music, but he's also very interested in ethnomusicology, and in fact had given us a seminar in American Indian music, which had really sparked my interest, because where I go in the summer time, I spend my summer at field headquarters, is right adjacent to two Indian reservations. And so we had been assigned to write a major paper, and I decided I would go out and do the first field work I'd ever done. I didn't even know what field work. I have to this day never taken a course in anthropology. So it's sort of baptism by fire.
That's right. This is autodidacticism.
I finally located a singer in the Lac Couturier Reservation, and in the dead of winter, it's about 20 below up there. Got him to record four songs to me. I had to go back three times before he was willing to do it. And I took the tape back home and laboriously tried to transcribe it into Western notation and analyze it and compare it to Chippewa music that Francis Densmore had collected 60 years earlier, and try to arrive at some conclusions about what had happened to the state of the music in the 60 intervening years. And got an A on the paper, and Professor Ward said, "Boy," he said, "you know, that's quite some singer you recorded." I think I was the only one in the class who had actually done field work, so he was quite excited by it. He said, "I think if you could go out and get him to record some more songs, you'd have enough material for you know what." So
the D word.
That's exactly what I did, although I had to change directions a couple of times because of some problems that arose. But I ended up writing my doctoral thesis on music of the southwestern Ojibwe. And,
did you say those reservations were near your home?
Yes, one of them I can see from my house. It's right on the main of them. I'm on an island.
Where?
It's in the Apostle Islands, about 90 miles east of Duluth, Lake Superior.
Oh, darn. I'm not familiar with that geography at all.
That's a beautiful area.
Is that where you grew up?
I grew up in Minneapolis, which is about four hours south of there. And started going up to Madeline Island at about age 14. Loved the place. Slowly been building a retirement place for myself.
That's great.
If I ever retire.
If they let you. Well, let's turn to some of the adventures that you've had here at the Smithsonian. How could I begin? You know, there are many starting points, I guess, but we might begin with some high points or low points, you know, most strongly remembered experiences that you've had.
Well, some of the most nervous moments, of course, really occur in conjunction with the Folklife Festival, because if you are curating a program, it's like launching a play on Broadway. I mean, there are so many things that can go wrong, and, you know, it's just... Give you a perfect example of that. Charlotte Heth, who is a dear friend and colleague of mine, who's with the Indian Museum here, is also an ethnomusicologist specializing in Native American music. And she and I, one year, have proposed to do a program on Native American song styles, in which we would bring representatives from about six or seven fairly contrasting repertoires and styles, and try to use it to point out what the differences are, and try to break down the stereotype image that most Americans have of Indian music, which is somewhat based on fact, but mostly not. And we had, from Charlotte's field work, she brought a couple of Navajo singers up, some Pueblo singers, and some from the Northern California Indian tribes. And I was to produce a drum or group of singers from the Northern Plains. We had decided on that, and at the time I was in touch with another ethnomusicologist who was a specialist in Indian music, who will remain nameless, but who we decided would be the right person to select the Northern Plains drum. We knew that if we did it, we'd hear from him one way or another. So. Anyway, he was given a deadline, and he had picked out a drum, gave me the name of the drum, and he just was a very difficult person and got more difficult as the time wore on. And it was getting down to the wire when the office had to have a list of the people finally who were coming to make travel arrangements and all of the other logistical things that had been done. And I kept calling this guy and stressing, I said, you know, we've got to have something in writing from these people. Are they coming or not? Well, then he insisted that I come all the way out to South Dakota and personally talk to these people. I mean, he was just really being difficult. And so I flew out to first to Minneapolis, then changed to a flight to Rapid City, and then rented a car and drove down to Pine Ridge. And by the time I got there, this was all supposed to be set out. He was supposed to have made the arrangements for me to talk to these people. But I got there, and he said, I'm sorry to tell you, but he said they left for a powwow yesterday in Wyoming. And I said, look, I said, you and I understand how Indian time works, but my office does not. And I said, this is extremely embarrassing. I can't, you know, can't deal with this. Then he insisted that the letters of invitation be translated into Lakota, and said, I mean, it's just being difficult down to the wire. And in the last, I found it behind my back, he also demanded his contract money to be doubled in the office. Paid him for it. But so I had to, you know, he assured me that this drum was going to come, and it was right down to the wire, and I think we even published their names in the program book or something. And it got to be such a nightmare as far as the deadline approaching that I believe actually there was an order that came down from the castle saying we have got to have a definite, you know, yes or no from these people. And so there was pressure put on our office and on me, and I kept saying, well, this guy has the rapport, and he knows the right drum, and he's sworn up and down, he's got him. So I gave him, you know, an ultimatum, come through by 8 o'clock the next morning, and I didn't hear from him until noon. And I thought, well, I have got to get into action really fast and come up with another group. And this is, you know, something that curators are having to do all the time, making last-minute substitutions. And it's maddening because sometimes it works. Sometimes it works out well. You get some unknowns that show up, and they're actually surprisingly good. Work out very well, and maybe even better than when you first selected. But I needed something to represent Northern Plains music because we had gone to a lot of trouble to arrange exactly how we were going to present this program. We actually presented it at Fairdon Auditorium in National History with a lot of media. We had some fairly innovative approaches. We had, Charlotte and I had created the minimal transcriptions of some of the songs we knew would be performed, and we flashed them up on a large screen and analyzed them with the public, and then the singers came out and sang them and said, see, they go up here and they go down here. This is the note they always end on, and so on. And I thought it worked out. There was some criticism level that it was too microscopic. It was like putting people in butterfly boxes or something. The Indian people had a good time. They all interchanged, but going back to the guy who was supposed to deliver the drum from South Dakota, I called up an Ojibwe friend of mine because their style of singing is pretty close, and I could make the same points with an Ojibwe drum. And I said, Ernie, I said, can you put a drum together in 2 hours? He said, yep, I'll drop what I'm doing right now. Got in his car and drove 150 miles to another reservation, signed up two or three singers, and by 11 o'clock that morning, I had another drum. So wouldn't you know it, 12 o'clock, the anthropologist calls me and said, I've got your drum. I said, sorry, it's too late. Oh my God, he did cartwheels and screamed and yelled and started saying I had put Sioux Indian and white relations back 100 years and, you know, we had to uninvite all those people, but, you know, he didn't deliver. And that's the sort of nightmare that curators, well, it's just one of the things that curators go through. Something that is also similar, particularly when you're dealing with foreign countries, is that you may have carefully laid out your plans and your list of the participants, but you really don't know until they get off the plane whether those are the ones that are coming or not. And, you know, all sorts of, once you leave that country, all sorts of political games start being played, and substitutions get made, and nepotism rears its ugly head, and instead of Frau Schwartz from a little town in Austria, you find that the ambassador's niece has been put into a dirndl and slipped on the train to make it look like she's one of the four. I mean, these happen all the time, but I mean, we've done this for so many years, we learned to swing with the punches, and if you get too upset at some of these things, you could just drive you into the wall. Well, that wasn't the end of that story, because I got the other group of Ojibwe were coming. Well, one of the singers who I'd worked with a number of years likes his drinks and managed to get lost at the airport in as far as coming in, and I thought, oh my God, we've lost him, you know, he found the airport bar and that's the end of it, and, but he somehow managed to get himself on another flight. I don't know how he did it to this day, and so he got surprisingly got there half an hour before the other group did. He spotted me from about half a block away from getting off the plane and yelled over me, hey, Tommy, how about an eye-opener? And I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a drinking session for 2 weeks that I was doing. But he, once they got going, he I mean, you know, they have beer out of the evening, parties out of the hotel, and he didn't go overboard, and it worked out pretty well, but, you know, sorts of the hair of your teeth, sort of the last minute things. High points, I'm always amused when visitors to the festival decide to interact a little bit, and I always applaud it, and they, you know, even just a very in sorts of questions that they ask or something like that. And sometimes you get some extremely clever visitors who come up with some things. I remember in the Swiss program, we brought a gentleman over from Bern who carved alp horns. Those large wooden trumpets are played in the mountains. And he was carving, and he had to have a specific type of soft wood to carve it properly, and we'd had to find an American equivalent of what they would have had in Switzerland. And, he didn't speak any English, and I can speak German, so the usual crowd of people were around watching him carve, and one person said, what kind of wood is that that he's carving, which is a fairly common sort of question, and I asked him in Swiss, and translated back, I said he doesn't really know because it was procured here in the United States. He thinks it's some kind of pine, and somebody from the back row said alpine. So, you know, those sorts of things cheer your day up.
That's right. Yeah.
We had some other funny things. In 75, we did Germany 2 years in a row. We did Germany in 75 and 76, and I'm pretty conversant with German customs, but they had brought a German band from north of Milwaukee, German-Americans, having a good time, and they have tended to, and arrived in their lederhosen with their cameras all draped around them, and their poor German long-lost cousins in their modest clothing looking at these people getting off the bus with their cigars and their Leicas and their yodeling hats and everything else, you know. An identity badge. And the wife of one of the performers from Milwaukee, the German embassy threw a social evening for us, and they had put out much too much to drink, and particularly the German Americans had really kind of sopped it up. And so the next year, when the ambassador heard that the same group was coming back, they said they weren't going to give a party. And we said, well, everybody else is. It's bicentennial, you know, they'll see that, you know, the Japanese embassy is giving a party. You've got to do it. Well, we're going to not have so much to drink this time. So.
Well, I'm pretty much
sure enough, they repeated the thing. And instead of a free open bar, they had, you know, a couple of cases of Beck's beer out and a couple of bottles of Rhine wine. That was going pretty fast, too. And at one point, we were doing some dancing, and I saw that this particular woman who had kind of been loud and abusive the year before was dancing with the German ambassador, and I thought, oh my God, I hope this is all right. And they sort of sailed past me, and I heard her screaming at him, what? Run out of beer at a German party? This would never happen in Milwaukee. The next thing I knew, the ambassador kind of clapped his hands, and several more cases of Beck's beer together happened. You never can predict what's going to happen.
In what capacities have you served at the Smithsonian?
Well, I've been on various committees. I was on Tony Seeger's first committee for Folkways. I've been on the Native American Grants Committee, Office of Fellowships and Grants. I don't know. There's so many committees that come and go, and some of them are short-lived, and others are, you find yourself, you know, reviewing proposals, or it's just sort of all part of the job, and you don't really think about it. It's kind of, I couldn't tell you how many committees I've been on, but some outside, you know, but that are connected to the job. I've been on the NEA Folk Arts panel for several years, also the National Heritage Award panel, which we kind of look on as being service to the field, you know. And, but that's part of the Smithsonian's charge. So, and I, you know, serve on cultural committees and a number of Indian reservations. And I've now, just last week, found that since I wrote a book on Indian lacrosse, I've now been put on the museum committee of the Lacrosse Foundation in Baltimore. I think they want to get some of my collection for their exhibit. But anyway, so these things kind of...
Well, I hope I can get a copy of that book. If they're selling it at the sales tent, I'd like to get you to autograph it.
Good, I'd be very happy. It's being published in German right now.
Is it? Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's great.
Which is ironic, not because they, well, there is a lot of lacrosse that's growing very fast in Germany, but my Germans are just nuts about anything to do with Indian culture. And, you know, they had that wonderful fictional author, Carl May, who used to write all the children's books over there. And I can't remember who the fictional Indian characters were. All the children in Germany grew up knowing about Winnetou, and I can't remember. Somebody's Indian friend, Winnetou.
Seine Freund.
Yeah, Seine Freund, yeah.
Well, let me see if there are any other... I think that we've covered sort of the kinds of questions that are there.
I would just add to the sorts of hair-raising things that curators go through sometimes. We had a musical instrument ship once that was supposed to go to Dulles Airport, and somebody had written Dallas on the box.
Oh,
and
no.
We finally got it back in time. But then there was the time that the Diana Parker could tell you better than the story, but all the crawfish that we had ordered for jambalaya or something or other had been shipped frozen and were thawing out at the airport and were found crawling all over the place. They'd gotten loose. And we were asked to please come and corral them all. The sheep got loose down when we were close to the Lincoln Memorial, and we had to send a couple of the cowboys with lassos up and corral them in the Lincoln Memorial, I believe. Things of that sort.
Other duties is assigned.
Other duties is assigned, yeah.
Well, has your title changed in your years?
Well, I was hired as an ethnomusicologist, and then for a while became senior ethnomusicologist. I don't think because of my advanced age, because at that time I was younger, but I think I was the only ethnomusicologist really in the office. I mean, since then there are two or three more that come in. I suppose it means that I've been around the longest. So that's pretty much what the title is related.
But it really doesn't do justice to the types of work that you do, really, because it's much more than just ethnomusicology.
Well, I said one of the nice parts about working at the Smithsonian, I think, is that, and working for this program, is it seems to me that as long as you're productive, they are very supportive about any direction you really would like to go in. My first book was specifically on the Ojibwe dance drum, and which our office published as part of the series I was talking about. Since the Ojibwe people are prime harvesters of wild rice, and I grew up in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and a lot of friends who go out ricing every year, and there had been a book published in Germany based on some field work done at Net Lake, Minnesota in 1947. I'd always thought that the book should have been translated into English, and sat down one cold winter's eve and began to translate it myself. The authors had both died, and began to realize, after about 10 pages of laboriously going through this, that it was just a stale rehash of most of the material that was already available in English. So I thought, God, you know more about wild rice than these people do. Why don't you write your own book? So I did. My second book, Wild Rice and the Ojibwe People, is, people tell me now, the classic on the subject. It was published by Minnesota Historical Society. I got into lacrosse by way of a drumstick. There's an Ojibwe drumstick that is absolutely identical to a lacrosse stick, only it's a smaller version. And I began to sort of read up. I have lots of friends. I never played lacrosse myself. I have lots of friends who do. I love the sport, and realized it had one, that it was originally an Indian game, but also that most people playing it today just do not give the Indians the credit that they should for originating it. And plus, I got interested in the whole relationship between game and music and ritual and warfare and so on. And began to find as I researched it that it was just a fascinating topic. At some point, somebody's going to have to write a revised edition of my book, but for the moment, it seems to be filling a gap. So
you'll be happy to know that at Salisbury State, which is very big lacrosse boys know about the Indian origins of lacrosse, and they also have been taught about its ritual aspect, which I was quite gratified. I had a freshman essay on this subject, and I was quite gratified to find out that they know that much. And I think that your book, which just came out last year, didn't it?
94, yeah.
94. That will have vastly increased their knowledge on that subject. And the more the better, I'd say. If these American athletes can get a sense of the sacred aspect of it, and the ritual aspect, I'm sure they will play it differently in their minds anyway.
Well, it's funny the reaction. I mean, I really wrote the book for players of the game.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
and
good.
Anyone interested in the sport, but I wanted to set the record straight on a lot of things, and there's been, I think for years, the non-Indian players of the game have kind of wallowed in their own mythology about the game's origins, and there are an awful lot of things that were being just repeated verbatim that were incorrect according to the research I was doing, so I wanted to correct the aspects, and I do talk a lot about the spiritual side of the game. But the last thing that I had in mind was to try to create a whole new generation of Anglo lacrosse players who see themselves now as reincarnated warriors out on the field. It didn't help to have the endorsement of the North Carolina coach saying, this book has given new meaning to the game, and now we can see, you know, we're part of this tradition, or I can't remember exactly how you want to say
that. Postmodern appropriation.
Really, exactly.
There's no way to avoid that.
I don't think so.
In fact, one of the things that I am very curious about myself, in a sort of research question sort of way, is what a folklorist can have to say about the appropriation of traditions by non-members of that group, because it happens all the time. I mean, it's been going on. It's even more obvious than ever with the sort of postmodern era. And do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I run into it all the time, and I'm, I guess my reactions are not, they're not consistent. I sometimes recoil at things, and it makes me angry, and I don't do anything about it, but, or you can kind of quietly straighten things out or try to, we had a whole, a program that I curated here several years ago called Indian Problems of Access. And I was trying to interpret the word access in as broad a way as I could. And there were some obvious things, Paiute basket makers, access to the materials that they need to make baskets, where all the willows that they traditionally used have been either cut down for pasture land or else have been poisoned. Which is then transferred to the way they split the willow with their teeth in their mouth. They get poisoned themselves. So it was material access. We had some Yaqui Indians from who have real problems in access to ritual paraphernalia, much of which has to come from Mexico. And given a fairly insensitive treatment by the border people, customs and so on, they had a real hard time getting this stuff through, and that was another one. But we also used lacrosse as a problem of access to recognition, and that was, so we put on a program of two young Indian lacrosse teams playing out here in the mall, and one from the Tuscarora Reservation, one from the Onondaga, and I wanted to show that it was really traditional for reservations to play against each other, and also that people started it at age 8 to 9, which is what these kids were at the time. So that was the access question there, recognition more than anything else. My voice is starting to go.
Well, let's just finish off by my asking if you have any sort of overall general thing to say about your experience working at the Smithsonian over these years.
Nothing but praise, as I said. It's just, it's like, I suppose it's like being at a wonderfully rich university campus without the the time constraints of teaching and preparing lectures, although you do, you know, I give, usually give papers, academic papers each fall in various societies I belong to, but, I mean, when I was doing the lacrosse book, for instance, I would find myself with a fistful of questions that I needed answered, and could simply move from one museum to the next, or visit a number of other curators and get them answered. I had a photograph of, for instance, of some Cherokee players that was shot in the 40s, and they all had large feathers in their hair. Now, I knew the Cherokee used certain feathers during the game, in that it was believed that the there was a sort of a magical imparting of the particular prowess or skill of the bird, of the feather worm, but I needed to identify this. And so I went up to, I think I called one of my friends in anthropology, and they said, well, you need the feather lady. And I said, who's that? Well, it's Dr. Laybourne. Roxy Laybourne. And so I made an appointment to see her, and I had the photograph. And she looked at it, took out her spyglass, looked at it closely. She said, I think that's a That's a wild turkey. It's not a, I don't think it's a, you know, she was, you know, trying to identify it. All of a sudden disappeared and came back dragging two large bird carcasses that were almost bigger than she was. And she said, yeah, it's wild turkey. Look here. And she started poking around in the under, you know, not the top layer of feathers, but the ones underneath. Yeah, it's a secondary feather of a wild turkey. And that's exactly what it was. And so I got that identification. Then I had a photograph of an Indian lacrosse goalie that had to have been shot. We had no date on it. But it looked like he was wearing protective gear from other sports. So I took it up to the curator of sports in American history, and we pulled out a, she said, looks like it could be hockey, probably hockey equipment from about the early 1920s. So we pulled out their reference catalogs for Spalding and a few other. Yeah, sure. See, here's this catcher. So, I mean, that's you've got this wonderful resource of experts that can, you know, really cut to the core, and questions are raised by you.
And I get the feeling that there is a kind of ethos at the Smithsonian, which is that knowledge is to be shared rather than hoarded.
I think so, for the most part.
And it's a, from my very, very thin association with the Smithsonian, I've always found a great deal of pleasure in just imagining that, you know, that people here see their job as finding information and then, and that it's creating knowledge, but then also disseminating.
Right.
Well, I thank you so much, Tom. This has been a lovely interview.
Enjoyable.
And I enjoyed meeting you as well.
Okay, great. Yeah, anytime you got a book, yeah.
That's great. Well, I hope it'll be today.